Well, good morning. Looks like a mostly friendly audience today, so that's good. I have to say that I was very honored to be asked to come and speak about soil science and land surface modeling. I work with a very interdisciplinary group with Michael Bartlage and David Gotches, and recently Rajesh Kumar. Johannes and I are the soil scientists on the team. And this is a funny group, because really it all started with a cold call, as I was working with TCEQ, which funds a lot of this work, and that's the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. And they had asked us to just go ahead and look at the NOAA model and see if we could do any soil science in it, which is something you don't get asked to do every day. So we thought, okay, well, we'll look at it. And we took a peek and thought, well, I think there's a few things that we can do, but there's no way that we can do this alone, because we're soil scientists, and this land surface modeling community is very well established and large, and I have no desire to learn NOAA. So it was really a cold call. I picked up the phone and I looked at NCAR and called David Gotches, and have to say that he was very welcoming. In fact, I said, you know, David, are you interested in working with the soil scientist? He said, absolutely. And we flew up to Colorado the next month, and he spent a day trying to get us up to speed on everything, and we spent an hour telling him a little bit about soil science, and we've been very busy ever since, haven't we, Johannes? So that's just a little bit of the beginning, but you notice what I did put in my title was the value of including, and you know, I think most of the room are soil scientists, and you recognize the value of soil, but it is important to express, I mean, if you work in soil and you do think it has value, it's important then that it should, that soil, the knowledge of soil, should be expressed in the things that you're working in. And one of the things that I've been working in lately is this concept of soil security. And the reason why I've gotten involved in it, it's a bit outside of the soil physics realm. But you know, on the news, you hear people talk, well, at ASA meetings, you hear food security. And everywhere we go in the environmental sciences, people talk about water security, energy sustainability, biodiversity protection. There's the big climate change thing coming, and also human health. And as a soil scientist, I'm always sitting, you know, watching the TV or hearing someone speak, and I get so excited because I think, wow, soil has such a big role to play in these grand challenges or these global existential problems. And I look around and, you know, in the big press releases, where's the soil scientist? There's got to be one involved there. And the point of all of that is that soil scientists generally work on capability and condition of the soil. Soil physicists, we're very in the capability. A few go into structure and look at condition. But there's other components of soil science that are very important. And one is capital, because we do live in a society that has an economy. And the value of soil in that economy is very high. There's connectivity, because there are people, everyone relies on the soil, and we need to recognize that. And when we do work in soil science, I just think that we need to be thinking about the socioeconomic components of what we're doing. And in the end of the day, I think that will be reflected better in policy. So one of my goals for the rest of my career is to really think about what I do and where it lies in, you know, the bigger picture of soil science or soil security. And one of the things that we know soil does is provide ecosystem services. So I was looking at the services and say, okay, well, what's reflected in the NOAA model? And the big one is the regulation of the water cycle, right? And that's something that I can do. There's also biomass production and the carbon component, which I will not in any way express expertise. But one of the things that we kind of did for fun is we looked at the Costanza paper that looked at the value of ecosystem services. And we just said, okay, well, here are the ecosystem services. This is what Costanza thinks that they're worth. And what does that translate for soil? And we just kind of did a very conservative proportion of contributed by soil estimate. And if you just look at water regulation, it's just, I work with economists now, so sometimes I'm embarrassed to show this because economists laugh. They say, "Ooh, that's a big picture there, Christine." But Costanza is an economist, and he went out on a limb and said, what is the economic value of these ecosystem services? And water regulation is, you know, $352 billion a year annually in, you know, the contribution to our economy. So, you know, I think soil scientists intrinsically value soil, but part of it is understanding how our society should be valuing soil. It actually is providing a lot of services to us. So the big question then is, you know, why is soil knowledge important in land surface models? And I think I'd like to show some examples of that today. Particularly, you know, we think about the water regulation, but water regulation has a huge contribution to human health. And an example of that is this is one of the brief simulations that we did across Texas to show the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality how, well, you know, they asked us, well, how important is getting the soil right? And we said, well, we don't know. We assume that it's important. And so Rajesh did some simulations with Wharf Kim, and we initialized NOAA where it kept the soil moisture dry, like a good Texas drought, and then the soil was kept moist. And we looked at the effect of ozone. So this is Texas, if you can't tell, and there's a little tiny white line that draws a transect from Dallas-Fort Worth to Houston, and you can see that on the bottom graph, Dallas and Houston, and that's just the difference between wet and dry soil in ozone layers. But the point, like, so what does that mean, right? Because I don't know much about ozone, but I looked up the what does that mean, and if you look at the middle graph where ozone is on the y-axis and then the distance is on the x, you can see the red line is ozone predictions in Texas for this day if the soil is moist, and then the ozone prediction if the soil is dry. And in the green are quote-unquote safe ozone levels, and the yellow area is where you want to keep people that are sensitive to ozone indoors a little bit, and those primarily, who's sensitive to ozone? Well, it turns out it's children. So when it's yellow, you kind of want to regulate your children a little bit about their exposure to the air. And then when you get into the orange area, then you really want to keep your children indoors. And I thought that was significant. And then the interesting thing is how that varies in space, right? Is that, you know, not only in the magnitude, but it looks like where it peaks is very different depending on the soils. So this is just a really broad example of the importance of getting that, valuing that soil knowledge in human health. So that's the question, right? If we can value our soil knowledge, we can understand better where soil comes into climate change, understanding how things are going to change, policy. You know, if we want to make decisions on policy, we'd like to have our value and our soil knowledge included in those, and then land use changes. So that's kind of the big overview. So the question I think that Scott wanted us to try to address today is, what could soil science contribute? So I sat and thought about this before I decided to pull all the graphs together. And I thought one of the things that we need to think about is better involvement in the discipline of pedometrics. You know, pedometrics not only works on the global soil map, but also on the properties that are assigned to the soil characteristics. And they have a lot to offer, but you go to the pedometrics meetings, and there's not really a lot of, like, biophysical modelers there. We talk about it, but they're not actually there telling us what's important and what's not important. The other one is just in general, you know, soil scientists have a lot of knowledge of the soil, and it's not really very well represented. And even more important, the land use effects on soil structure. You know, the condition component is really not there in a lot of these models. And then lastly is, we can include them all we want, but we don't want really know, like, what is the impact of this improved soil information? Or as one of my grad students told me the other day, it's like, yeah, you need soil scientists to point out the known unknowns. Like, where is the relevance of the outcomes of these models? Because we're soilies, right? We have a bit of a handle of what we know and what we don't know, and maybe what's more important than something else. And so I just made this list, 1, 2, 3, 4, of where soil knowledge is used in the land surface model. So first, CONUS, where is the soil in the world, right? And what texture is it? And secondly, what is the capability of that soil? And we really represent that in NOAA as a lookup table, right? This lookup table of biophysical properties, and it's based on soil texture class, and it's just assigned. And secondly, soil is represented in NOAA, and that it's usually assumed to be, the default is that the soil is 2 meters deep. If you live in Texas, you know that's a bit iffy. And lastly, you know, condition. And condition is not in NOVA, but it could be. But right now it's just quite implicit that, you know, the Richard solution will take care of it all. And condition's not really probably where it should be. And that's been a big issue as we've changed, as we improve the soul knowledge in NOVA. We see other things go haywire, and Mike is like always telling me, we can fix that later, Christine. Let's focus on what the problems that we're creating as it is. So first thing that we looked at is this lookup table. And being a naive soil scientist, I thought, oh, well, they're probably just using the Rawls lookup table, you know, where NRCS took all these measurements and they just averaged everything based on soil texture. But no, in fact, it took us, research scientists of mine, quite a few months to track down where all this information came that's in this lookup table. And then what we did is we took the soil database for Texas and said, okay, well, what would happen if we made up our own lookup table with data? And what happened is all these numbers in red are where we really disagree. There was 118 out of 190 of these parameters that were significantly different from Texas soils. And you go, well, that's Texas. Texas is big. Texas is special. And yes, we know that. But what this doesn't say, because we like to have be a little Texas-centric because we can be, but what this really says is the Texas data really matched the Rawls database, the Saxton and Rawls database, quite well. So it was in line with the NRCS database. And the NRCS database isn't in NOAA. It's not the lookup table. It is now, but it wasn't. And what does that mean? Well, what that means, if you look at the red, we've mapped the wilting point and field capacity by texture. Field capacity is on the x-axis. And on the green is the field capacity that we revised with using USDA numbers and Saxton and Rawls kind of simple texture-based petotransfer functions. But if you look, you go, okay, what does that mean? Well, look at the red. Look at the distance between the red lines and the distance between the green lines, especially on the sandy end. NOAA had some wet sands that could hold some plant-available water. I mean, it was a miracle. They probably had a lot of biochar in there or something, right? But, you know, I mean, make light of it. But it's amazing, right? And as a soil scientist, my eyes were opened. I thought, oh, my gosh. I don't know very much, and we can improve this thing. At least, you know, we can make it more representative of what we know. And so we did. So we took two areas in Texas. So here was a pedology bent, right? I thought, where would this be most important? And I thought, East Texas, because we have clay pan soils. We're sandy on the top, clayey on the bottom. And in Texas particularly, we have these really quick transition clay pan soils. And so the soils all map sandy in Texas, East Texas, but they're clayey underneath. And I thought, oh, this is a great experiment. And so what we did is we took a Palestine as our East Texas clay pan soil, and then Central Texas is Austin, where we have the vertisols, but this is a vertic kind of soil over limestone. So it doesn't make a vertisol, but it's high clay, shrinkswell, smegmatic soil. And so we have, and then another soil that we chose is in Brant. And it's also a clay pan soil, sand over an argillic horizon, but it's in an ustic soil moisture regime. So that was another, you know, eutic versus ustic, right? Like wet and kind of dry. We would expect these things to behave differently when we reparameterize that. So those are the three locations we chose. And then we just set up some model simulations. And we also, in these locations, we have soil moisture measurements. No flux measurements, but we had soil moisture measurements. And so what we did is we said, okay, we'll run NOAA as usual. We'll put in that default table, because we know we can do that. And then we'll put in a little pedology, and we'll say, okay, we're going to let the soil layer like it does in real life. And this is the result we got. So there's a lot of information here, but each graph is a different soil. And the top is Palestine. So remember, it's wet, sandy on the top, clay on the bottom. And the red line is NOAA business as usual. Okay. And then the green line is where we just revised the table. And then the blue line is where we did our best guess at good pedology. And what changed in Palestine, where we have a lot of water, we had a lot more ET. Most of that, I would have thought it would have been in transpiration. And there was an increase in transpiration throughout the year, but the big increase was in evaporation because that clay pan's holding the water in, and it's just a wetter system now, suddenly. And then when we went to Austin, of course, you can imagine that we went from a deep soil. So first we revised, and so the soil held less water, and then we allowed it to be heterogeneous. And then you can see in the blue line, suddenly the evaporative fraction went really low. I should have said the y-axis is evaporative fraction. And so suddenly now a lot more of the energy is being fractionated into sensible heat. And then in Brant, dry, didn't matter. If you don't add water, you can't partition energy associated with it. But so there was very little action that happened in Brant. Okay, so here we go. This is one of my points here, validation. How do you validate these models? They're so complicated. And so in this situation, we had water measurements. I'm going to skip this slide because I know we're going to be short on time. But essentially what this shows is when we add better soil information, even the stress on the plants looks more realistic, like that it's not stressed in the winter and it's stressed in the summer. But so here we are. What we had to validate is we had these CRN sites that had some soil moisture. And first thing we had to do is we had to scale it, you know, between wilting point and wet so that it looked like it was even taking a measurement of soil moisture compared to the model. But the take home here, this is just Palestine. And what we have is we start with default and we go down. And we did two things. First thing we did is we compared it to measurements, and those are the black lines. And then the green line is what we did is we said, well, you know, all these models are really constrained by wilting point and field capacity, and it's so arbitrary. It's still a lookup table. It's not the wilting point field capacity at Palestine. So what we decided to do is just take a model that's accepted by soil scientists, RZWQM, none of these models are perfect, but we decided this would be our gold standard comparison to the soil science community. And the interesting thing is as we improve the soil knowledge in both models, they come together. So in the bottom graph is our best guess at soil knowledge in both models, and the models kind of agree, and they're kind of close to the actual soil moisture measurements. But it's funny, at the very top, when it's all we do is have this default parameter table, so we put the NOAA information into RZWQM, and NOAA and RZ don't agree at all. But then when we change the parameter table, NOAA and RZ start to agree. And then, as we put in the fact that soils are heterogeneous with depth, they agree with the measurements, too. So that was encouraging. I will say that this was the best-case scenario that was in Palestine when we had water, so we could actually model the processes that we thought that the pedology contributed to. So that's just one example. But the other example is in space, right? Where are these soils in space? And if you're familiar, if you're staying up with pedometrics, you know it's going wild and nuts out there. We're getting a lot of really good maps, digital high-res maps. Nate Cheney's going to talk about his, and Nate, I'm going to share some results with yours too, so don't be too shocked. So what we did is we ran NOAA now in 2D space. So the first example you saw was 1D space. And when you talk to pedologists, this is what they talk about, like we can map soil. So it's very exciting, like, okay, well, we'll give NOAA better maps, the state-of-the-art in pedology maps, and see how it works. But then you get back to the validation issue. How do you validate these things? So we said, well, first we'll validate just by comparing them to each other and saying, oh, that looks different. And then we'll validate them by some soil moisture measurements, some point measurements. And then the other idea we had is, well, we could validate it using Alexi output, which is using the surface temperature and calculating the latent energy in space. Okay, so the first thing is we'll compare model against model. So all of this is NOAA model. And what we did is we took default NOAA as usual. If you picked up NOAA and wanted to run WharfChem or something, the NOAA that you would use is the base. And all of these other simulations are subtracted from that. Okay, so this is difference from NOAA as default NOAA as usual. And so if you're along the zero line, you're really similar to NOAA as usual. And so let's look at the purple and the red. And the interesting thing is the purple is, let's do with the red first. So the red is just changing the table. And so you saw those big differences, right, when we changed the table. But if you look at relative to some other crazy pedology stuff we can do, it's not that big of a change. The big change actually comes in the light green and the blue, where we always get this wrong. So the blue is interesting because we used Saxton and Rawls pedo transfer function, so they're continuous based on clay content. But both the blue and the green use heterogeneous soil with depth. So that was the biggest change we got, was saying we know soils are not uniform with depth. And remember, this is averaging all over Texas. So it's including soils that are alfasols, mollisols, vertisols, you know, a lot of soil orders. But acknowledging that soils have differences in depth made a huge difference. And then the bottom two, so the purple and the yellow, are using Polaris, which Nate will talk about later. But Polaris is really the ultimate attempt at using all of our digital soil mapping knowledge to make the best soil model we can make. And Nate even put in the soil physical parameters. So we're no longer even looking using a lookup table. We're using, you know, the best that pedometrics can provide. But we didn't run it with heterogeneous. Those are just really what you can say with the Polaris is those are examples of the best soil physical parameters and the best location of the soil in space, but not the heterogeneous information. So what does that mean, right? So we can compare models, and then we can compare models to measurements, and this is a mess. But really, if you look at the bubbles that are the measured, and these are measured soil moisture values, so the big blue line, you can see that are the measured values. And all this says is, first of all, we're not very close to measurements, which is sometimes a little disturbing. But if you start looking at the trends, what the trends say is as we improve the soil information, we're actually starting to at least have the magnitude changes the measurements have. And if y'all show up to Johannes's talk, you can just study that in depth. The other thing that we can do is we can compare the latent heat in space. So in the top left-hand corner is the Alexey estimate of latent energy in millimeters, and then the four to the right are just examples of you know, better pedology in DOA. And the interesting thing that we notice is in the bottom right-hand corner, you start to see the soil map of Texas emerge, and that's when we start using the physical properties out of the Saxton and Rawls pedotransfer functions. And so this was just for 1 month in the summer in Texas. So what Johannes did then is he said, okay, he took all the maps from Alexey and all the maps from NOAA, and for each space just did a correlation in time with Alexey. So this is a correlation coefficient in time for each location in space. So the blue numbers are very low correlations, and the yellow numbers are high, or the yellow colors are high correlations. So in East Texas, we're getting a little bit better. But still, there's some things going on with the soil that we just don't understand. Johannes just got these graphs a week or two ago, and we really need to sit down and study to understand what's going on. But that's what soil scientists can do. That's what we can contribute. So at the end, I just want to mention condition is important. I think it's the holy grail of soil physics sometimes. You know, we have to understand how our management affects soil structure, because that's the partition. I talked about latent heat and sensible heat partitioning, but in soil physics, we talk a lot about what happens to the rainwater. And that was a crazy thing in East Texas. As we started upping that argillic horizon close to the surface, suddenly all the water gets partitioned to runoff, and the things just become unstable, and suddenly East Texas gets very dry, and we know that's not real. But it is really happening. So I just wanted just to throw this out there while I had some attention of soil physicists in the room, that soil is managed at the field and landscape scale. And we need to remember that, and the NOAA and these land surface models are simulating at larger scales, but it's shrinking. The scale is getting finer, and the computers are getting faster. So what I'm going to tell the soil physicists is the LSM models are coming for us. And we've got to get this condition thing figured out. So in the end, I just say, where are we? I think we're at a point where we need to engage pedometrics types. The soil pedometricians are creating these maps. They're using statistics and math and having a really good time. And we need to go, hey, guys, based on what we're modeling, these are the important things we need to know. Can you focus on those and get them right? Thank you. And then the next thing we need to do is, as soilies, We need to figure out how we want to validate these models and what we're going to believe and what we're going to consider to be helpful. And then lastly, we need to communicate better. Soil scientists can identify the known unknowns, and we need to participate, make a few cold calls, and get engaged with this community. And so I can't give a talk and not show a Texas Vertisol, so there you go. Yes.
So when you mentioned the soil database that you would prefer to use what's available in NOAA, then you mentioned that it was available later. What was the process? How do you get those kind of databases into
NOAA? You call Mike Bartlage. Bartlage. I always say his last name wrong. But Mike is rewriting the community code to handle input from these databases. So one of the things, we've engaged Christine Malling at University of Wisconsin, has a lot of knowledge on how to get these multidimensional soil databases into these three-dimensional kinds of models. And so she's been working with Mike, and you know, we're engaged with the NIC and the Polaris people, and what we're trying to do is make it so that the community code will just take it. And that is a lot of coding. Like right now, our newest project with TCEQ, literally the focus is getting all the work we've done right now solidified into the community code. So then the community code will take it. And the next thing is, where do you get the databases? You can talk to Nick about the Polaris database, but they're just, I guess I would say that we're at the very beginning of being able to get the global databases. They're coming. And the reason, whole reason why I even started this project a couple of years ago is I was thinking, you know what, they're coming. And if we value soil science, we need to be ready for when they're here so that we can use that information. So it's almost, it's not quite there, Scott, but it's coming. And this is not the only LSM. Are the other LSMs getting ready? Okay.
That was
my first question when I started working with David. I said, hey, let's put in soil and break this thing, and we couldn't break it. Really, we put water on it, and we did all sorts of things with, you know, because right, you're at like at node number 3, and suddenly it's a clay. And we couldn't really break it. Like, the biggest problem that we found was runoff partition. So what happens is the water starts backing up in the sand, and then suddenly all the water just goes off and it's gone. So I guess that's as close as we came to breaking it. But no, it's a good question, because that's what I thought. When I worked with John Norman in Wisconsin and we put macropore flow into palms, the first thing we did was break palms, because suddenly there was this rush of water and Richards couldn't handle it. But it tended not to be a problem. I was surprised. It was not a problem in NOAA. Maybe we didn't do the right thing. Great question. Yes?
Do you see the texture class as a pitfall or a limitation to modifying NOAA? And if so, would you like to have a data set of contagion properties to test that out?
Well, that's what Polaris is, a data set of continuous properties. So the way that we have a lot of talk about this, because this is what Mike is doing this year, and we are going to make it so that, you know, you have the default table, but then you can also like put in your own model of soil properties. And so that, okay, so I'm really bad at remembering words, but this is all about the pre-processing. It's all about the pre-processing, and that's where you really need to be collaborating. But yes, we want to make it so that you have those options, that if you have this new idea, like a pedometrician has a new idea on how to deal with these soil physical properties, let's use them. Let's try it out. Let's make it flexible. Yeah. John, you're not allowed to ask any questions. No, I think that the infiltration is solved for just based on the soil water content. So it's a bucket approach. Like Nick probably may, someone else may know better than I do, so I'm going to give my best guess, best attempt at it. Yeah, that the infiltration is not used from the Rawls lookup table. It's more of a how wet is the soil, can it handle more water at the moment? And that's why when we moved that argillic horizon closer and closer. I had another student that messed around with the depth of that clay pan, and as he moved it closer and closer to the surface, what happens is suddenly it's just saturated really quick, and so the water goes. So it's not, so in some way the hydraulic conductivity is driving it, because it's how fast can the water redistribute, but the redistribution is only driving runoff to the extent that if it can't redistribute it to get it dried down a little bit lower than saturation, that the water will leave. It's a lot of work that needs to happen.